Okay, everyone. Hello. Good to be back. Let me look at, give you the date. It's May 3rd, 21st of ER, although it's after that now, because it's nighttime, at least where I am. Let me turn off my sound here on my other computer so we don't, you don't hear it. As always, lots of good stuff to share with you. We'll do that for about 15 minutes, and then we will get into the material we have to do today. We're at, this is class number 47. My wife, let me share this with you. So when we started these classes, she says to me, so what am I going to be, what am I getting classes on? So I say, my new book. So she says, well, what's the title? I said, the title is my new book. She says, well, you got to give it a title. No one's going to come. I said, I don't have a title. That's what it is. She says, so how long is this? She's thinking, I say, 6, 8 classes. I said, I think about 50. She said, are you crazy? She's almost always right. She said, no one's going to come to 50 classes. I said, well, that's how long it's going to take. This is 47. And she says, "That's you got to do it differently. And what can I say? We're 47. We're 20 pages from the end. And Baruch Hashem, people have come, even with such not an attractive title as my latest book and class 47. But
two more classes is Matan Torah. Got two more classes and that's it.
Coming to Shavuos, exactly.
Okay.
You know, we've covered so many issues that there's always stuff in the news. And there's actually something I did want to say, but because of the tragic events last week, I'll hold off on it till next week. We don't need to criticize at a time like this. But there's always stuff in the news relevant because we've been discussing so many different things. So let me call your attention to something that was in the... hold on, I gotta then pull up my thing here for you. Gotta show like something here. This was in the news. This is a historic event. This is from the Jerusalem Post, but it's on the Or Torah Stone website. It's Rabbi Riskin's. This is the first time there's ever been a female rabbi appointed, as far as I know, to a synagogue by herself. We've had these titles, Maharat. She's actually a rabbanit, in which they're in a clergy role, to use that term, in which they serve alongside a male rabbi. But here you have a woman who's finishing up in another couple weeks. After 5 years of learning, she's been given smicha from Or Torah Stone, and she's becoming the rabbi, the rabbanit, the only clergy in an Orthodox shul. And what's significant about this, I think, is that this is not open Orthodox. This is from the center of modern Orthodoxy. You know, it's Or Torah Stone. It's Rabbi Kenneth Brander. He was the rabbi for many years of one of the biggest shuls in the country, the Boca Raton Synagogue. He was head of the YU's Center for the Jewish Future. And this is under his auspices. The fact is that this is a complete opposition to the OU statement that women can't be clergy, even if they're, you know, one of 10. But now that she is the clergy, and how this is going to work, because obviously Rabbi Brander, he comes to America every year, he raises money, he speaks at shuls, or is he now going to be out and not acceptable because he's doing this? It's not going to happen. Everyone knows he's part of mainstream modern Orthodoxy. So it's a very interesting phenomenon here. It's America is very different in many ways. We spoke about this already, that in Israel, they don't seem to have these issues. I showed you the pictures from YU. They can't even come up with a title to give the women Torah teachers. I have to call them professor because they don't. And so Israel's operating in a very different mode, and we'll see what happens here. I think it's really interesting, and we'll see where it goes.
Doctor, if I may interrupt for
yes.
A second, I don't know if it's in this article in the Times of Israel, Dr. Brander actually talks about how historical this is. In other words, he's totally aware this is revolutionary and this is this area that halacha has to go. In other words, he's not like, oh, she's a rabbani, like
that here. Right? It's an important moment, but he's going against, he could never do this in America.
Of course,
So
of course.
it's an interesting phenomenon, and we'll see what happens with this. I mean, the OU doesn't have really any authority in Israel, so they can't enforce anything. But we are connected, of course. I don't think the schools are now going to start saying you can't send their to Lindenbaum and things like that. Okay, another thing. Joseph emails me. Last week I spoke about the we spoke about the was it last week or 2 weeks ago the Yiddish, how the Ramah is thinking in Yiddish, and therefore he says Leil Chamishi, which really means Wednesday, and he thinks it's Thursday night. Joseph gave another example of this, and he's absolutely correct. We call it Shushan Purim, but it's really Purim Shushan. If you look at all the Sephardim, when they refer to it, they call it Purim Shushan. We call it Shushan Purim because of the Yiddish, but in Hebrew it's not. And as I said, if you look in the Sephardic literature, they call it Purim Shushan. Rabbi Michael Broyd sent me this. This new Sefer just appears, Avnei Derech, Volume 16, by this very prolific author, Elchanan Naftali Prince, Jerusalem 2021. Lo and behold, Simon Kuf Ayin Zion, it's Nisue Kohen Im Gioris, the question we dealt with. Can a Kohen marry a woman who converted as a child under three? And the very first four words of the tshuva is, B'sefer Igros Malchei Rabbanan. He deals with this the tshuva of Rabbi Greenblatt. He rejects Rabbi Greenblatt, but he quotes Rabbi Uziel, which I didn't know, because it's not in the Mishpatei Uziel. It's in another sefer. Rabbi Uziel says the exact same Rabbi Greenblatt says, but he says, "Don't rely on me. I don't. It's halacha v'olam ma'isa." So that's of interest. Last week, David corrected me because I read the bracha for the seeing the new fruit tree as Shelo Chiser Be'olam Oklum, and he says Shelo Chisar. Well, I checked it, and it's a machokas. Ashkenazim and Sfardim. All the Sfardim say Chiser, and all the Ashkenazim say Chisar. I asked Rabbi David Yitzchaki, if you don't know who David Yitzchaki is, he's like the expert on Masora and grammatical things, and I asked him what's correct, and he says they're both correct. And he cites the Radak's Michlol, that PL sometimes it's with a patach as well. And Rav Yaakov Emden has it the Ashkenazic way. So, but thank you for that, David, or I wouldn't have looked it up. I think I can say this because this was said even before the disaster we had this week. And It's not really what I'm going to speak about next week, God willing. I'm also going to speak about more about the Mechitza. We don't have time now. I'm going to show you something. But you have to promise not to ask me where I got it from about Mechitza. Unpublished document, never before appeared in print. And you'll be quite surprised about this Gadol B'Yisrael. And then I'll tell you about other Gadolim, including Rav Moshe and the Chazon Ish. People think of the Rav. It's not just the Rav. It's others as well, especially the one that everyone says he would never do it. Wait till I show you this unpublished document I have. Rabbi Mazuz, in his Parsha sheet last week, I think some of you will find this interesting because everyone's talking about Meron. At the end of the day, I think most of us realize that all these sites have no history. They're not, the Meron doesn't go back very far. The other Amoraim up in the Galil, that's just very recently. They picked them in the 50s, many of them. Kever Rachel, according to many Rishonim, it can't be. It's in the wrong tribe. Maaseh Machpelah is the one that we know that goes back very far. That has a tradition. But the others don't have the whole idea of Lag B'Omer associated with Yechiel Goldhaber came to my son's yeshiva last week, and he spoke about Lag B'Omer. There's no association of Lag B'Omer with rejoicing. There's no association with of Lag B'Omer with Rashbi and his yahrzeit. This is all very recent stuff. None of this, there's no history. And bonfires, who knows where bonfires come from? But Rabbi Mazuz, in the last Parsha sheet, we're going to see the last letter from Rabbi Mazuz this week. If you've been to Israel, you also up in the Galilee, you know there's Rav Meir Balhanes. Rav Meir, that's Rav Meir, the famous Rav Meir. They have a grave for him as well. So this is what Rav Mazuz, and they have a Hilula. They know what day his yahrzeit is also. Yom Yud Dalet Iyar. This is all Rav Mazuz says. How did this come about? Because there's no history of this. It's very simple. In Tveria, they saw that all these Jews are coming, they're passing Tveria, and he's talking, he's saying this is in the time of the Ben Ishchai, or even a little, in the time of the Ben Ishchai, so 100 years ago, in Tveria, they're seeing that all these Jews going to Rosh Hashanah Bar Yochai, they pass Tveria, and they're not doing anything in Tveria, they're not stopping, not buying anything. Ki ain sham kever shel tzaddik, because Tveria doesn't have, well, it has the Rambam, but it doesn't have one going back to the olden days. So what did Rabbi Azus said? They said, Amru, imein lanu tzaddikim nachapes otam. If we don't have tzaddikim, we'll find them. Chitzu amatzu et Rabbi Meir Balanes. They searched and they found Rabbi Meir Balanes, and then they gave a hilula right next to Rashbi. And that's there's a whole book about this, how in the 50s, they discovered, in quotes, all these kvarim of these big rabbis up in the north. These is just people just found them. And this is a common theme. If you, on my Morocco trip I spoke about, there's one kever there everyone goes to. It's because in the first half of the 20th century, someone had a dream that this was some great rabbi who no one heard of. And all of a sudden, they declare that's where the kever is. You have kvarim in Morocco and in Israel. You have the Ben Ishchai. We spoke about the Ben Ishchai classes. The Ben Ishchai is a kever in Baghdad, but he also has a kever in Jerusalem because he magically flew to Jerusalem. So kevarim, it's very strange, the whole kevarim thing, not to mention the Rambam says you shouldn't go to a kever. Let's see. We'll see. We'll go three, 4 more minutes, see how far we get, because Shemaria sent me a nice long thing. Here's the book, the Rabbi, the Rav. So here you have it. We spoke about the case with Shaul Lieberman, and when Shaul Lieberman says to the Rav that there's this text that says that a Kohen is forbidden for coming into contact with an animal, and although Rakefet always quotes it as the Karaganiza, the Gaonim, and that's what Rav Shechter quoted, the Gaonim, I'm assuming that if it's an accurate recollection, the Rav was speaking off the cuff, or maybe it's not an accurate recollection, because here is word for word, from the Rav at the RCA convention in 74. He quotes Lieberman here, and he says that he told me they discovered a parchment, a Megillah, in which it was stated unequivocally that Cohen is enjoined from defiling himself with the Sheretz. Do you know what they call the Dead Sea Scrolls in Hebrew? Megillot Qumran. That's what Lieberman said. They found a scroll. That's the Megillah. And I told you already that that's when we will go into it more when we do the Lieberman classes, that that's where this comes from. It's from the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's not from the Gaonim. Of course, you want it to be from the Gaonim just for Rav Shechter's story, so you could say, quote the Rav as saying that my grandfather knew how to learn better than a lot of these Gaonim. Just because they lived in the Gaonic period, they're nothing special. The Rav felt this about certain Rishonim as well. Okay, I'm going to hold off. Shemariyahu sent me a lot of stuff about Lubavitch and the State of Israel. I will hold off on this till next week, and something from Rabbi Ganak also, because I see it's already coming up to 8:45. Maybe at the end, if I have a chance, we'll come back, but I doubt it, because we have good stuff. But I hope the very last class, I don't know if I'll get to all of it, but I have a pile of stuff that people have emailed me. We have a lot of people listening to the classes, Baruch Hashem, and stuff I want to get to, but also the last class, when we finished with it, those letters that weren't included. And because I think you'll find that of interest as well. So we're in the Sefer. We're on page Shin Mem Bet 342, Simon Kuf Nun Tes, and this is the last letter from Rav Herschel Shechter. We saw about 8, I think, or 7 from him. And there's some interesting things in this letter as well. I sent him the volumes I published, the 2 volumes, the writings of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Actually, this time, I think I sent him the first volume earlier. I think this time I only sent him 1 of them. The second volume of Kisvei Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. At class number 1, I said that this volume we're studying together is the third volume, Torah volume, published with Catholic money. The first and second were the collected writings of Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg that I published. They're out of print, but you can see them on HebrewBooks.org and Otzar Chochma. And the second volume deals with Hashkafa, articles, and I included many letters in the footnotes. I have a whole collection of 500 unpublished letters of Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg. Maybe my next project, the Hebrew project, because I do English and then Hebrew, will be finally a collection of all of Rabbi Weinberg's letters. But I sent it to Rav Shechter. And he writes back that on Shabbos, he spent time reading the book. He read 15 articles. Erich Jacob Weinberg, he speaks about philosophical matters. He speaks about history, about the yeshivas. He speaks all sorts of things. I divided into his first early years when he was a rabbi in Lithuania, and then when he was in Germany, and then the post-war years. He speaks about the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt. One of his essays there is great because he speaks about how important the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt is, and we have to recognize this as the one shining moment in the Holocaust, because the typical Haredi perspective is that the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt is a terrible thing. It's suicide and all sorts of interesting stuff about the state of Israel. And then he says, Rav Schachter says, a few times I tried to read Rabbi Weinberg's book, Lifrakim. Rabbi Weinberg has a book of drashot and essays. And he says, he's exaggerating here. He says, Lo hitzlachti lahavin af milah. He says, I couldn't understand anything. Rabbi Weinberg's, I don't know what to say because I understand it. But he spends his time, I guess, learning Gemara. I don't understand the Gemara that he understands. But some people say about Rav Kook, I finished my book on Rav Kook, that it's so hard, it's so complicated. It is, but it's like anything else. If you spend the time on it, if you work on it, you get a hang of it. But the language of Rav Kook is so, it's so highfalutin. There's this guy, Nadav Schnerb. He has a website where you click on it and it gives you two passages. One is authentic Rav Kook and one is just gibberish. Just highfalutin words put in the wrong orders. And you have to guess which one it is. And it's not always so simple because you have to see it. If you know Rav Kook, it's very funny. He says, I can't understand anything. And he says, maybe now I'll be able to understand Lifrakim after reading these essays. And then he says, I found a few ideas that Rabbi Weinberg speaks about that Rav Soloveitchik has the same ideas. Is it possible Rav Soloveitchik was influenced by Rav Weinberg? He asks me, I don't think so. But they were both influenced by German Orthodoxy. The Rav was in Germany. So that's where the influence is. I think so. And then he asks, has anyone ever tried to see if there's any influence of, he doesn't call him Rabbi, Rabbiner Hirsch in Hebrew, on Rav Soloveitchik's thought? It's an interesting question. And I don't think there is any. As far as I know, the Rav never quotes Hirsch. He quotes the Rav Kook one time that I know of in Pinchas Peli's book on Tshuva, which you summarized of the Rav's drashot on that. I don't know if the Rav ever read Hirsch. He knew German Orthodox thinkers, but I don't know if Hirsch is a very different sort of approach, but it's a good question. I don't know. And I don't think anyone has ever seen any influence. Here's the time where you'd like to see what's in the Rav's library, to know in the house, what books he actually had. You see from like Rav Moshe, you can tell what type of library he had. It's a very limited library. He didn't need all these achronim. The Rav, it would be interesting to know what type of books he had. Then he says as follows, and this is where I could use some help. He says, for a few years, I davened on Shabbos and Yom Tov at the Aguda. There's an Aguda show in Washington Heights. And I sat next to a balabas named Kot, K-O-T-T, I guess. His father was Lithuanian, and he remembered Weinberg. That's how he used to call him. If anyone listening knows who this Kot is, I'd love to know. He says that his father was a merchant, and he went to Berlin. He was going to go to South Africa, but he got stranded there. But then he says that his son still lives in Brooklyn, Kalman Kot. So if anyone knows Kalman Kot, years ago, before the internet, I looked for him. Now it reminds me, I'm going to look for him. Maybe it's just, I find people sometimes just by Googling them. It's incredible, modern technology. And then he says that that Rabbi Weinberg would eat at them, at their house almost every Shabbos, and he would speak at about the Parsha on Shabbos, and the neighbors, the Tzibor, would come. And they would, after Shabbos, people would write this down of what Rabbi Weinberg said, and it would be nice to get this material. He says that one thing I remember he said to me was regarding this pasuk. Let me show you the pasuk. In Bereishis 25:14, it says the children of Yishmael were Mishma, Duma, and Masa. And this is where Schechter says that this pasuk is in the that based on this pasuk, which is found in the Hakdama, the introduction of the Quran, everyone is obligated to listen, mishma, to be quiet, duma, they're deriving from there, and masa, to bear the burden, or something like that. Well, really, Rav Schechter remembers, but not completely. This isn't in the Quran at all. They don't have anything to do with Hebrew. This comes from the Rambam. This comes from the Rambam's letter to Yemen. He writes as follows. He says that our sages told us that we have to bear, I'm reading the translation, the prevarications and lies of the Muslims in silence. And they found an allusion to this, that we have to bear their oppression in silence. Mishma. Mishma means we have to listen what they say. We have no choice. They criticize us. Duma, we have to be silent. We can't reply. And Masa, we are we endure it. So this was a, in the Muslim world, they had this tradition that how you live with the Muslims, you derive it from these verses. You don't say a thing. You let them say their ideas, and you be quiet and you bear it. You don't grin and bear it. You just bear it. Then he says someone maybe should interview his son, which I will, if I can find him, I'll try him. And then he says, it appears to me that I heard either from Kot or in YU that some years after the end of the war, that Dr. Belkin, who was president of the yeshiva, there was a talk that they would invite Rabbi Weinberg to come to America, to come to YU and give shiurim. And Weinberg's reply was that he would not be connected to any institution that had secular studies. And in response to this, I heard once Dr. Belkin, when he spoke in public, he said that we will never agree to turn our yeshiva into a seminary, like in Berlin. It'll be a yeshiva, not a seminary. Well, again, we have confusion here because it is true that YU was very interested in having Rabbi Weinberg come. He refused to come. We have letters of him discussing it. He didn't feel he could go to a place where he's going to be second fiddle. Both Skokie as well as YU, he was asked by Tells as well. Rabbi Soloveitchik was the big person there. And by Weinberg, he says that for the honor of the students, he was the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of seminary in Berlin. For him to go to another place where he's not the big person in charge, it would not be covered for the students. I think probably he also felt it won't be covered for him. It's not easy to reduce yourself from being in charge. Remember what Rabbi Weinberg says. He's very honest. He says that I don't chase after kavod, but if they give it to me, I'll take it. that's an honest, he's honest about that. And I have the correspondence talking about this. And in the end, he didn't go. And he never would have said that he wouldn't go to a place where they teach secular studies. He believed in the idea of YU. Berlin wasn't a university, it was a seminary, but all the students went to the university, and it's a much better if you have the secular studies in the university. And the truth is, and Rabbi Weinberg writes this to Rav Chaim Ozer, that the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin was a yeshiva in a complete sense. It was a yeshiva. They called it a seminary. Well, YU's called, the rabbinical school's called Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary. He says, why are we not a real yeshiva? Just because we require they have to learn Jewish philosophy and parshanut? That's also a yeshiva. And the rov minyan ubinyan, as they say, the majority of the time was spent on Shas and Poskim. So the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin was a yeshiva. It was not like one of these rabbinical seminaries that you had in Rome or later in Paris. No, it was a complete yeshiva entirely to be a musmach there. It was harder than YU. Everyone had to write three tshuvot, original tshuvot, and which you don't have to do at YU. YU just have to know the information. This you had to show originality. If you didn't succeed, they gave you a lesser degree, like a preacher sort of degree. So but it is true that Dr. Belkin spoke, he wanted it to be a yeshiva, not a seminary. When they had the election between and the people who were running, Rabbi Jung versus Belkin and the Rav. The Rav was also, it was a three-way race. Really, it was between the Rabbi Jung and the Rav. And Belkin sort of became the compromise candidate. They didn't want either of them. They couldn't decide on them, and they went with Belkin. But they said that if Young became president, he turned it into the rabbinical seminary, because he was the most machmir rabbinical seminary. That is, that it would be, it wouldn't be like Volozhin. You come into YU in the morning, it's like Volozhin. So yes, it's true that the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary was a yeshiva. However, it also, they focused on academic Jewish scholarship as well. Whereas at YU, that's in the Revel Graduate School, it's separate. Rabbi Soloveitchik also spoke about this. He spoke against the idea of synthesis like they had in German Orthodoxy. He said that they're two separate things. We have the yeshiva in the morning downstairs, and this is like Volozhin. And then you go to the university. That's Siman Kuf Nun Tet. This is the last letter from Rabbi Schachter. And now we get Siman Kuf Samech, the last letter from Rabbi Mazuz. In fact, let me just pull up, since it's the last one, pull up something here so we can take a... show you a picture. Here we go. Here I am with him. The Rambam speaks about the Rimigash as his Rebbe. He refers to him as that. How could he call the Rimigash his Rebbe? He never studied with the Rimigash. His father did. But that shows you that you can have a Rebbe even if you don't actually study. And a number of Sfarim speak about it, that today we have Sfarim. So you could have a Rebbe from someone's Sfarim. So myself, if you'd ask me who my Rebbe is, it's not like I went to YU and studied for 4 years under Rav Schachter or by Rosenzweig or something like that. You're looking at it now. Only because that in a Torah sense, my Torah learning is more influenced by him than anyone else, because for 30 years, I've been... immersed, and I was given an approach, a derech, in learning and in different fields of Jewish learning from Rabbi Mazuz. So in that sense, I see, if anyone asks me, sometimes people do, who do I consider my Rebbe? I consider him, but not a Rebbe that some people speak like that. Well, I don't know, because in Lithuania, there's a difference between a Talmud and a Chassid. You know, in Lithuania, you were a Talmud, you weren't a Chassid. I don't feel like I need to defend Rabbi Mazuz. If he says something I think is crazy politically, it's fine. I don't feel bound in any of those things. And there's plenty of his views I don't accept. But in terms of a Torah learning, and that's why we had 32 letters, I think, and I hope I introduced you to this very interesting person that... So we get to the last letter of Rabbi Mazuz from Tunisia. Rabbi Kelman emailed me a few days ago, because maybe some of you also saw it in the Times of Israel. They had a report on this every year. They get like 8,000 people. They go to Djerba for the big Lag BaOmer celebration. Now this year, they just about 100 came. A group came from France, and there's other people from Tunisia. So he says, well, when are we going? So God willing, we're going. We're going to do all our things if Mirza Hashem, if life gets back to normal. This, the last letter from Rabbi Schachter, the title is Concerning Rabbi Chaik of Weinberg. This is called, it's on page 343, Notes on the Collected Writings of Rabbi Chaik of Yaakov Weinberg. I sent him both volumes. In 2009, I published two volumes. The first volume of the writings of Rabbi Chaik of Weinberg is on halacha, Jewish law. Lots of different shuvot. I could publish a second volume now on that. There's so much has appeared since then. And some of the shuvot are quite significant. And the second volume is like we spoke about, Mor Hashkafa. He thanks me for the book, that it's full of chachma and bikiyut, and sometimes walking through the raindrops, as it were. He says, however, in the second volume, there's things that it's difficult to digest, such as Rabbi Weinberg being Melamed Schus, finding some positive things to say about actual assimilationists, such as Herzl and Achad Am, and to find elements of holiness in them. And anyone who sees this is going to assume that it's permissible to regard a Rasha as a tzaddik. Okay, well, to this I'll say to Rabbi Mazuz, again, it's not Das Torah for me. I don't, he's wrong. And really, my Rebbe is Rabbi Chaik of Weinberg, really. If if you have to, he's the one that I'm most connected to, so much so that sometimes when people have criticized me, they say things like, well, you're Rebbe. It is true that Herzl came from a religious background, but to call him a completely assimilationist, that's not true at all. The whole essay, the essay of Rabbi Weinberg on Herzl is the idea that he's a Baal Tshuva. A Baal Tshuva doesn't mean someone who's irreligious, doesn't have to mean and observe Shabbos. It could mean someone who was totally lost to his people and a secularist and comes back and is connected. Someone, Chabad recognizes this. If some woman starts lighting Shabbos candles and that's all she does, she's a Baal Tshuva. Not a complete Baal Tshuva, but she's a Baal Tshuva. His essay focuses on that Herzl, how he turned from someone with no connection to Judaism to someone who, although he has no background, was able to become a hero for the pious, simple Jews of Eastern Europe, and not just the simple Jews, for all the Jews of Eastern Europe, the typical Lithuanian, Russian Jew who's downtrodden, and they looked to Herzl, and when they found out he had a Hebrew name, Binyamin Zev, even more so, they saw him as someone giving them pride. Yes, the Hungarians and not all the Litvaks spoke negatively about him, but the point of this essay is to show that every Jew has positive things, and Herzl, there's positive things. If you haven't seen the essay, which Rabbi Weinberg published twice in Hebrew and once in Yiddish and added on materials to it. One of his students, who became more right-wing, said to me before I published this, do you have to publish the article on Herzl? He says, because the Haredi world, they'll see it and they'll say, you know, and he's very accepted, Rabbi Weinberg, among the Haredim. If they see the article on Herzl, maybe they won't like him. I said, of course I'm going to publish it. I don't censor him. And he published it himself, as I said, twice in Hebrew and once in Yiddish. And it appeared and it hasn't hurt his reputation in the Haredi world. Isaac Breuer saw the value of Herzl and his charisma, as did Avram Eliyahu Kaplan. So Rabbi Weinberg's not unique. So I would have to disagree with Rabbi Mazuz. Now, what about Achanaam? Okay, well, Achanaam was basically a I wouldn't say assimilationist, because they don't want you to, he never wanted you to marry non-Jews, but complete secularist, Achanaam, obviously. But his essay is simply, it's a good Torim Derech Eretz, trying to see what Achanaam has to say, respond to the bad points, call attention to some good things, because even a person like Achanaam, if he speaks about, you know, the importance of the nation, that's a value. And to try, Rabbi Weinberg's attitude was that he wrote this in the early part of the 20th century when these authors were very significant. And you can't put your head in the sand. You have to respond to them. You have to say, what does the Orthodox world have to say about what Bereshevsky, he wrote about Bereshevsky also. What do we respond? What do we have to say? We're big enough to call attention when they make good points, but also criticize the negative points. Rabbi Weinberg's attitude is not like, well, it's a Achanaam, we won't even read them. It's Muktzah Machmas Mihus, we can't even touch it. No, we read it and we respond, hey, we're all been influenced by Achanaam. Achanaam is the one who said, more than the Shabbat, Jew have kept the Shabbos has kept the Jew. Rav Moshe Feinstein even quotes this. People think it's Chazal. There is the Taz says something very similar, and you do have sources, but the exact Lashon of Achanaam is not Chazal. So then he says, because of this, he's being honest with me, because the writing, the second volume has some of these problematic essays where Rabbi Weinberg is interacting with people like Achanaam. He doesn't even mention Bereshevsky. Bereshevsky, for heaven's sakes, Bereshevsky is the complete Nietzschean atheist. He's like the worst, the transvaluation of Judaism. But Bereshevsky comes out of Volozhin. He wrote great stuff about the Nitziv and others before he went off on his own way. And Rabbi Weinberg, look, he's a great author. You have to recognize that. But I get it. In the Haredi world, even the quasi-Haredi world of Ramazuz, you're not going to read Bereshevsky, even if it is to challenge him. So what does Ramazuz says? He says, therefore, Kerach Beis, Nishar Etzli. And volume one, you're not telling me, says, therefore, I'm going to keep volume two. I'll give volume one to the Beis Medrash, so the students could see it. So what he's saying here is basically, I don't want the students to see this. They I don't want them to see, you know, about Bereshevsky and Achanaam. So I'm keeping volume two, and volume one is, and that's in line with an old rabbinic approach that not everyone can handle, like the movie says, not everyone can handle the truth. Not everyone can handle it. There's always been this idea in the Haredi world that those who can handle it, they can read everything. But the masses, the Talmidim, we keep it away. So it's just cute. Or Mazu says, as Rabbi Weinberg has some terrible stuff here, so I'll keep the book. And the other one that's just with a halacha, that I can put in the base medrash. But then he points out something fascinating. He says, he makes a few comments, printing mistakes and others. He says, how amazing is what Rabbi Weinberg writes on page 219 about the approach of Reb Chaim of Brisk in contrast to the Vilna Gaon's approach. And he says, based on this, in our yeshiva, we study in accordance with the Vilna Gaon. So let me tell you what Rabbi Weinberg says. Where's my pages here? Hold on. Yeah. Rabbi Weinberg says as follows. I think most people listening know who Reb Chaim Soloveitchik is. Created a revolution in Torah study, the analytic approach. Once you've had the analytic approach, it's very difficult to go back to the old days to just study Gemara to find the halacha. It's not really that satisfying. I hate to say it, but if you look at some of the shiurim of rabbis who are not in the analysis. And when I say analysis, it's not for your Chaim, you have Shimon Shkup, you have Tells, you have all that. But the way of just study for the sake of getting to the halacha, it doesn't attract people. The Rav himself said that Reb Chaim came up with his derech because in his era, people were being challenged by philosophy, by the universities, by mathematics. He had to show a sophisticated approach to Talmud study. I find it a bit difficult, you know, to understand when he says that, because that what the Rav says makes it seem as if Reb Chaim consciously came up with this approach to keep the best and the brightest in the yeshiva world. I don't know if the Rav really meant it, although that's what he says, because that implies it's artificial. But that's what he says. Other people will just approach it that Reb Chaim's a genius, and it was a different era where people were thinking in a different way, and he was able to, not that he ever studied any of these things, maybe because it's in the air, whatever it is, the analysis that he came up with puts Torah on a very high, much higher level. The question, however, is anyone who studies Reb Chaim, you have to ask yourself, what is it true? What I mean true, is it historically true? Did the Rambam mean this? If you study the Rambam, you know what his basis is, let's say the Gaonim, from the Gemara to the Gaonim. And we know how the Rambam thought because we have response to the Rambam. When they have problems, they write to the Rambam and he never gives a brisker answer. He always gives an answer, you know, there's a mistake here or a simple answer. So is it historically correct? And does it matter? Let me read you what Rabbi Weinberg says. He says a few things. He says, I said once to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik that the Torah writings of his father, the Gaon Reb Chaim, are true from the standpoint of logic, but not from the standpoint of the Emetai story, not historically true. Reb Chaim had a different method of learning than the Rambam. Rabbi Weinberg says, first of all, that Reb Chaim's derech is true. It's true in a Torah sense, in a logical sense, but it's not true in a historical sense. That is, the Rambam didn't mean it. So that brings us to the question. I'm writing an essay for Chakira on this very topic. I promised them a long time ago I'd write this because I mentioned it in an earlier article. Can something be Torah true, but not historically true? That is, when we try to interpret Rishonim, does an explanation need to be in line with original intent? This is something that in modern literary theory there's a lot of talk about. And today, no one assumes that the interpretation of a work, say you take Shakespeare or something, that when you interpret it, it has to be a true interpretation is the interpretation Shakespeare had in mind. No, when Shakespeare wrote it, he put it out there and you could have other interpretations. Works have true interpretations, even if they're not historically true. That is, the interpretation does, if I'm the author of a work and you give an interpretation, I say, well, I didn't mean that, doesn't matter. Because the work takes on an independent life. Do we say that in Torah writing as well? And there are plenty who do say that we say that, that we can interpret the Rambam, even though the Rambam himself did not have that in mind. I don't know if Reb Chaim thought that. If you speak to Briskers, they say, no, this is what Rambam had in mind. But we have many others who say that, no, we can interpret the Rambam, we can interpret Shulchan Aruch, because, and Rav Lichtenstein has a whole essay on this, a lecture, which they didn't publish, in which he acknowledges that what we interpret in the Rishonim, although you could say it's latent, they didn't have this in mind. He acknowledges this, but he says that's what part of Torah is. There's two aspects of Torah. There is the Torah that just wants to uncover the past. That is what the earlier ones had in mind. But then there's Chidush. Chidush is not about uncovering what the earlier one said. Chidush is actually creating new Torah. We all have the ability to actually create new Torah that extends Torah truth. And that's part of, that's basic to the Brisker approach, at least according to Rav Lichtenstein. And the Rav himself says the same thing or similar thing. And then he has another letter here, which I quote. He says as follows. He says he's writing to Gabi Cohen. Gabi Cohen for years was the principal of Michala. Maybe some of you remember him. And he writes, Gabi Cohen was from Switzerland. He's a student of sorts of Rabbi Weinberg. He says, I read Rabbi Soloveitchik's essay on his uncle, the Grizz, Rav Elvel Soloveitchik. We spoke last class about the Hespate that he gave, the great Hespate. I think it's been translated into English as well. It's the best discussion of the Brisker method available. He says about the Brisker method that they took Yoredeia out of the pots and pans and put it into analysis. So when you learn Yoredeia, it's not just about pots and pans now. It's about understanding conceptual systems. And the Rav goes on, it talks about, as I said, you know, the people who learn with the Rav Chaim's approach, they're married to the Torah. Everyone else, it's like Kiddushin, not Nisuin. It's a Torah study. It's the most complete form of Torah study. I could see if you're not into the Brisker Derech, you might find this a little offensive. But he says, the language of Rav Soloveitchik is amazing. And his style is Maxim. But the content is Mugzam Umufras Maod. Rabbi Weinberg says that the content of this essay, which is it's the greatest cheerleading, I guess you could say, for the Brisker method that has ever been written. The Rav has a few of these, the greatest ever written. His Hespade for the Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski is the greatest exposition of the Das Torah ideology ever written. The irony is it's written by someone who would later come to reject the whole Das Torah idea after he saw the Holocaust, that Das Torah didn't actually, do such a good job during the war, Das Torah, or Das Teira, as the Rav would say. But Rabbi Weinberg says this is completely exaggerated. And listen to this. I wouldn't say it, but this is, someone says he had, Gabi Cohen was Machon Gold, you're right, not Michala, sorry, Rabbi Cooper was Michala. But he writes as follows. I mean, this letter is great because a bunch of these letters, I go to Gabi Cohen. I haven't spoken to him in years, but I knew him then. And I asked him once when I was preparing my stuff, do you have any letters from Rabbi Weinberg? He goes, yeah, I have a few, but nothing significant, just a few. I said, well, I'm still interested. He gives it to me. This letter is one of the most significant letters Rabbi Weinberg ever wrote in terms of his approach to learning. And later, Gabi Cohen would himself print it. I think he forgot this letter. But then he has another letter he gave me. I published it also, which he speaks about Agnon. Rabbi Weinberg wasn't so impressed about Agnon. He says, he tells us some stories about what it's like to live in Galicia. Galicia. I don't know if Rabbi Weinberg had such an appreciation for literature. But then he says as follows. Listen to this. Kach kotvim anashim ba'alei kat. The way Rabbi Soloveitchik is writing about his Zaidi and the Brisker method is the way that people in a sect write. You know how people in a sect, they're, everything revolves around them and their approach. And anything outside their approach is second best. Listen to this. Kamo anshei chabad uva'alei hamusar. Just like Chabad. He's writing this in the 60s. Even then, Chabad, people would think, kankat's not a good word, but ba'alei hamusar. Rabbi Weinberg comes from the Musar school. He wrote the most important essays on the Musar movement, but he later came to move away from it because, again, he saw it as moving is like a cut that you're in or you're not. If you're in the movement, if you're in the Musar group, then you're great. You're with us. But if you're not in it, well, you're second best. And he couldn't accept that. He understood Musser is great, but not everyone has to be part of it. That's the problem. I guess that's the difference between a group and a cut. If you're in a cut, you assume that anyone who's not with us is really fundamentally missing out. And it's sort of like it's Nebuch that they're missing out. So Mitoch Mamro, from Rabbi Soloveitcher's article, Mitkabel, you get the impression, Ki'ilu HaTorah Lo Nitna Al-Yedei Moshe Rabbeinu Chalila, you get the impression that the Torah was not given by Moshe Rabbeinu, Ki'im Al-Yedei Reb Chaim Mibrisk. It's as if the Torah was all given by Reb Chaim. And that's exactly the impression you get. The old joke is that Reb Chaim's father, the Beis HaLevi, said that I was born before Matan Torah. Because, and that's what they speak in the Brisker circles, they say, you know, before Matan Torah, that all the people before Reb Chaim, it's before Matan Torah. And that's the sense you get, that the Torah before. So what about the Rishonim? Well, the Rishonim, they were, the attitude in Brisk is that they were able to say in a few words all the concepts that are later able to be developed out of it. Rabbi Weinberg doesn't accept that. Rav Lichtenstein is also skeptical, although he thinks it's latent. But then you get to the Acharonim, let's say, before Reb Chaim, they're Talmid Chachamim, but they're missing the meat. So Rabbi Weinberg responds very sharply, and then listen to this. It is true, he says, that Reb Chaim brought in a new type of pilpul based on logic to the yeshivas. And when it comes to logic, yesh kol adam chayluk, everyone is a share in it. Everyone can understand a svara. Everyone can make a chiddush like Reb Chaim's derech, chefetz gavra, because it's conceptual. And he says that's why the talmid, the yeshiva students are all attracted to it, because you learn a sugya and then you start thinking of these conceptual things. Masha ain came, he says. But however, if you look at the Shach and Rabbi Akiva Eger, in order to make chiddushim and the way they do it, you need to be a great bucky. You need to know, you know, Shas in order to be sharp. That's the way the other Achronim, like Rabbi Kiva Eger and others, did it. That once you know all of Shas, then you can come up with sharp ideas. And he says, since everyone wants to be a Machadesh, come up with new ideas, they prefer Reb Chaim to all the other Gedolim. And then listen to this. Hold on to your seats, my friends. I once asked Rabbi Soloveitcher, he calls him a grid. He had great respect for Soloveitcher. Louis Bernstein, I found in the Louis Bernstein's family gave his archives to YU. For years, they told me about it, and I knew his widow. His widow married to someone from Scranton and lived across the street from me in Scranton, and she told me about all of his stuff, and he had a diary, and then she passed away, and then I get the message that it was all given to YU. So I go to YU one day, and I think we have... I'm going to spend the whole day there. First, I asked for the diaries. He has like 20 volumes of diaries that cover everything. It would have such great stuff. And he, with Zionism, RCA, he was the president. Problem was, I can't read it. The handwriting is so poor. Eventually, I guess I could learn it, but I was only there one day. I came in from West Orange. I didn't. So then I said, give me the other boxes. So many boxes. I found good stuff there. I published some on the Sfarim blog, letters by Nissen Alpert, you know, threatening to resign from the RCA. If in Louis Bernstein's presidency, he spoke before the conservative rabbis and they had the conservative rabbi speak for the RCA. It's only about 25 years ago, but you can never imagine today that the RCA would ever have a conservative rabbi, the head of the conservative rabbinical assembly, speak to them. And letters from Rav Aaron Cutler, all sorts of good stuff, including a letter from the Rabbi Weinberg. Louis Bernstein was a chaplain in Germany. He sent a shayla to Rabbi Weinberg. And he must have said to him, I know that you're a Rebbe from Rabbi Soloveitcher, because Rabbi Weinberg writes back and says, basically he says, Chas v'shalom to say that Rabbi Soloveitcher is a student of mine. He would come to Shir that I gave a few times at the rabbinical seminary, but everyone knew in those days that he was a great Gaon. He's not my student. He honored me by coming to the Shir. And he says, even at the Rav's young age, the Rav was in his 20s then. Now, the Rav was born in 1903. So this is in the 20s. He's not yet 30. This is talking in 27, 20, 28, 29, 30. He says everyone then already knew what an evil he was. He says, and Professor Tursky told me that Rabbi Weinberg was the first one at the hospital when Atara Soloveitchik, that's Isidor Tursky's wife, was born. She was born in Berlin. Rabbi Weinberg was the first one there at the hospital. So they were very close in those years in Berlin. He says as follows: I once asked for my Soloveitchik when he was in Berlin, Mi gadol mi mi, who is greater? Hagra mi Vilna, the Vilna Gaon, or Reb Chaim mi Brisk, or Reb Chaim? What kind of question is this? Of course, the Vilna Gaon. Nah. But what does the Rav say? He replied to me, Ki benogea lahavana Reb Chaim gadol af me Hagra. When it comes to Havana, Havana is conceptual analysis. When it comes to understanding in a conceptual way, Reb Chaim was greater than the Vilna Gaon. Unless you're in the Brisker school, this is the sort of thing that you'll just see as over the top and unacceptable, because no one is greater than the Gra. But he's not saying he's greater in entirety, but in terms of Havana, understanding, that is conceptual, because the Gra didn't do that. But Rabbi Weinberg says, "Lo kein adavar," it's not true. The Gra searched for the emes hapshuta. He searched, for the pshat, the truth in the pshat. V'lo kein Reb Chaim, not Reb Chaim. He says his logic and his ideas, sarot, cannot be fit in, not in the language of the Gemara and not in the language of the Rambam. Reb Chaim hayak kashukas atzmo Rambam chadash. Reb Chaim was a new Rambam. He was brilliant. Avalo mefarish Rambam. But he was not an interpreter of the Rambam. Thus I said to Ramosha, the father of the Soloveitchik. In other words, Reb Chaim is great. He's a new Rambam. But he's not really an interpreter of the Rambam. Reb Chaim is using the Rambam to come up with his own ideas, his own way of understanding the halacha and the sugyot, and conceptually to understand different halachot. But the Rambam never actually thought this. Reb Chaim is using the Rambam's formulations and halachot to create this big castle. But don't tell me that the Rambam himself thought this. Because Rabbi Weinberg says, no, that's anachronistic. He couldn't have thought that. In my book, Studies in Maimonides as Interpreters, I have a section in the end in which I have passages for other passages from Weinberg about Reb Chaim and other things about the Rambam. I quote another thing he says, that the writings of Reb Chaim, they're true logically, but not mibachina historit. The same thing we just said. And I quote one more passage from his student, Avram Abba Weingort, where this is after the war. This is Montrose, Switzerland, where Rabbi Weinberg says very sharply, he's discussing a dispute, a kasha of the Raivad on the Rambam, on the way Reb Chaim explains it. And he says that what Reb Chaim says is nit emet. It's not true, Reb Chaim says. How do we know? For vas? Er zakt azoy gut az er machtem Raivad for an amaretz. He says, we know Reb Chaim can't be right, because if it's really what Reb Chaim says, then the Raivad's an amaretz. Because after you see Reb Chaim, it's so clear, it makes so much sense. Therefore, he says, it can't be what the Rambam had in mind. The point here is that Rabbi Weinberg, the first one really to express this idea that chidushim can be true in a Brisker chidushim we're talking about, in a conceptual sense, but they're not true in a historical sense. Rabbi Weinberg has a historical mind. He's an academic scholar in a different addition to a posek, and he knows historically that the Rambam didn't think like this. If you want to know how the Rambam thought, it's the tradition of the Gaonim. And then you look at the Rambam's students and the tradition. He didn't think that way. And therefore, he's insistent that it's great, but it's not the Rambam historically. We can't say that that's what the Rambam thought. And Rabbi Mazuz is very impressed with this and says, this is why we follow the Gra, because we want pshat. Most yeshivas went along with Reb Chaim's approach. Not Rav Kook, incidentally. Rav Kook refused to. Rav Kook in Volozhin was one of the only ones who wasn't taken in by the Brisk approach and did not become a student of Rav Chaim. He stayed with the Netziv. And we see very clearly when Rav Shimon Shkup wanted to come to Israel and people suggested that he could maybe be Rosh Yeshiva at Merkaz Harav, Rav Harlap writes, sends a letter to, I forget who he sent it to, explaining why this was published in the Rav Zvulun Harlap Jubilee volume. When he retired from YU, they put it in a volume. And Rav Harlap says that Rav Shimon Shkup would not work here at Merkaz because Rav Kook focuses on, he's before Matan Torah, I should say. It's the old approach of learning, not the new approach. So there was no conceptual Talmud study in Americas. It was Talmud study the old way. You do the Gemara, then you do the Beis Yosef, you look at Gemara Rashi Tosfos, you try to focus on what the halacha is, you look at the major achronim, but not conceptual. Rav Kook was not conceptual. And Rav Mazuz's yeshiva, it's about Yun. It's not conceptual. I don't know if we've had many Sephardim who've studied in the Ashkenazi yeshivas, but none of them come to mind as great maspirim in the conceptual fashion. The next two tshuvot, I'll just tell you, we're not going to do them, so we'll skip them. I'll tell you who they're from and then introduce the next one, is from Rabbi Shmuel Ashkenazi, the great bibliographer that we spoke about. I had questions about these Sfarim. There's nothing in them that have any broader interests that worth sharing. About a Sefer Shar HaMelech, another Sefer Ramatayim Tzofim. So we'll skip those. And what we're going to pick up next class is page 346. The author is Rabbi Mordechai Spielman. Not a household name, but I'll tell you about him next week, the Sfarim he wrote. One of the most important Sfarim that have not been put on Otzer Chachma. We're going to deal with the issue of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid's commentary on the Torah that Moshe Feinstein called to be banned. I'll tell you that whole story. I'll tell you the Tzioni. And then we'll see what Mordechai Spielman has to say. And then we'll talk about a figure. I'll show you, just show you a picture. We'll talk about this individual a little bit. Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, Shir he's known as. He's what you call modern Orthodox. Doesn't look it. I talk about him on the trip to Central Europe. We speak about him. I always make the joke when I speak about him that here you have a guy, he's son-in-law of the Katsos, really a goan in learning, but he was very modern academic. Today he'd be called modern Orthodox. But look what he looks like. He looks like a Haredi. We know that we have many Haredim who look modern Orthodox. They're clean-shaven. They look like a typical modern Orthodox. And that's nice. It's good. Dress should not determine who you are. But we don't have many who are really modern Orthodox, but look like this. I once said this, and someone said to me, what about Meir Schiller? Because Meir Schiller, he's a Sfera Chassid, and he's a Hirschian. And so I said, you're right, maybe Meir Schiller. But the typical modern Orthodox person doesn't look like this. So we'll speak about why Rabbi Mordechai Spielman is so opposed to Shir. Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport next time. And then we're going to get into Hungarian Orthodoxy. Three or four letters about five letters. And this takes us to the end of the book before the appendix about Hungarian Orthodoxy, ultra-Orthodoxy. For good or for bad, people have different views about that. So I hope we have at least some Hungarians with us. So we can talk about what it was meant to be, because you had many Shomrei Torah and Mitzvos Jews in Hungary. You had Gedolei Yisrael in Hungary who were not Orthodox. And when I say they're not Orthodox, I don't mean they're not Orthodox like in their open Orthodox or something. No, they're not Orthodox, because in Hungary, as we shall see, Orthodoxy does not mean Shomer Torah and Mitzvos. It means you belong to a club, you pay dues. And that makes you Orthodox. And if it's like today in America, if you didn't belong to the OU, if your shul didn't belong to the OU, you couldn't be called Orthodox. You'd have to be called something else, like status quo, as we shall see. But that'll be next week, class number 48. It is interesting that we are, as Rabbi Kelman, we're going to be class 49. We're coming right up to Shavuos. It's like, okay.
49th after Shavuos, because 2 weeks tonight is Shavuos.
Ah, so we'll see.
So 49th after Shavuos, okay.
And what you just privately texted me, I'm going to mention last class about Dr. Lyman's talk next
week. Okay, I didn't know. I don't want to share it without your permission.
No, well, I'll mention it next week. Dr. Lyman has a thing on, I was there that weekend with him. That was.
I know that. That
was a long time ago when Perish of Bichrosset. So I'll speak about that. Mel says, Rabbi Rakefet is extremely upset about this. I assume this means the woman rabbi, the rabbanit. I think what Rabbi Brander would say to Rabbi Rakefet is, you've been living here in Israel, what, over 50 years? You have to come a little more Israeli. You sound like a centrist from America. That's what Rabbi Brander would probably say. I don't know, but I get it. It would not go over well here. yet. Who knows? Baruch says, you say it's not open Orthodox. Is there open Orthodox in Israel? Yeah, there is. Their partnership Minyanim in Israel, they have open Orthodox in Israel. Definitely, you have it. But there are different groupings, but there are people. You have Beit Hillel, this rabbinic group there. You have others. You definitely have open Orthodox in Israel. From Daniel Sperber would be associated with open Orthodox, I think. And you have others. YCT doesn't have a branch, but they go there. They have all. They used to have all these events with them, and they would never have an event with Or Torah Stone. They would have events with these other groups in Israel. They definitely are modern open Orthodox. Unfortunately, one of the rabbis who I think, sorry, I got something in my eye here. Sorry, I was quite shocked that a friend of mine, I didn't even know about him. When I say a friend of mine, more of an email friend of mine, but he came to visit me right before he went back to Israel around Purim time last year. He gave me his book. I helped him on his book. His name is Ronan Neuwirth. He, I think, would be regarded as open Orthodox, although he was a Rav of mainstream shul in Ranana. I just saw that in the Jewish Link, they were doing a memorial for him. He passed away before Pesach. And I didn't even know this. And this was a person who we've been corresponding, and he published a very nice book. I guess that's his legacy. A very nice book on halacha in the modern world. Barry says, the issue will be the RCA. A number of RCA members have criticized this appointment. Well, yeah, but I mean, what does it mean? They criticize it. The RCA is American organization, not Israel. Rabbi Brander heads up now Or Torah Stone. If they tell me you have to give the RCA membership, I'll give him his RCA membership, but they're not going to say that. How could they say that? The guy was a member mainstream. He was part of the RCA, a macher in the RCA, and they're not going to force him to give it up. And it's an Israeli thing. It's not an American thing. This could never happen in America. It shows you what we spoke about, that Israel is different. And what's the reference to the Rambam saying one should not visit Kvarim? It's in, if you email me, I'll give you the exact, it's in Hilchos Avil. He says it. You shouldn't make a habit of going to Kvarim. The briskers never, because that the briskers never, I don't know offhand what parak it's in. The briskers never went to cemeteries. And the Rav says, however, after his wife died, he couldn't help it. The emotion was too much. It shows you that the Rav was not a complete ish halacha. He tells you that the emotion was such that he went to the cemetery, even though his family never went to cemeteries. I'm going to read you next class something from Rabbi Ganak, another example to show you that the Rav was not a complete ish halacha, because he tells you that although this is the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, emotionally, well, I'll tell you next week. Hyman says, the claim is that Rachel was buried in Ramah, the home of Shmuel. I believe that this is one of the instances where Ramban changed his mind about a location after he came to Eretz Yisrael. I'm not sure if that was one of the occasions. He did change his mind. Rabbi Tsuriel published on the Sfarim Bug a number of years ago in Hebrew a list of all the Rishonim who, according to them, this can't be Kever Rachel because it's not the proper area. My attitude is as follows. It doesn't really matter. Because whether it is or isn't, because you know, the kever, in any event, you're talking, it's many feet down. When you're at these places and the people are trying to connect to the feeling of, you know, what Rachel meant to us or what this sage meant to us, does it really matter if the sage is buried down here, you know, 30 feet below, or if the sage is 2 miles away? I mean, does it matter? It doesn't matter at all. David's tomb, that's not even a Jewish site in Jerusalem, where it's on Mount Zion there. Somehow it became a Jewish site, but it's a Christian, as far as I know, it's a Christian identification. So Rachel, if she's not buried there, okay, she's not buried there. It doesn't mean you can't, assuming you can daven there. Rabbi Kafach says, again, because the Rambam says you can't learn Torah, you can't daven in a cemetery. So he says all these things are no good. Baruch, what you texted me, if you can, very good. Thank you. Hyman says, I believe after becoming the leader of the Zionist movement, Herzl would not give his son a bris. No, that's a legend. Wait a second. I didn't know. Ben Yehuda. It's a legend about Ben Yehuda. So they say that Ben Yehuda. It's not true. Herzl, I don't know if that's true at all. I'm not sure about giving his son a bris. I know he had a Christmas tree. But I think that's before he got into Judaism. I'm not sure. If you can find a source about the bris. And if it's true, it'll just mean that, coming from the completely assimilated background Herzl came from, he didn't see the significance of bris, but he gave kavod to rabbis. And the question is, do you believe in a conception of a Baal Tshuva of sorts when it's not complete Baal Tshuva, like Chabad does? And that's the essay. It's a beautiful essay. If you haven't seen it, check out Kisvei Rechei Yaakov Weinberg. It's called Herzl Ish Hadat, that Herzl was able to come from no religion at all and to come to appreciate what it meant that there's a Jewish people and that we have a destiny. And that's a form of coming back. Baruch says the Hasidic followers may look like Hasidim, arguably. Okay, so now Baruch is saying something interesting. You have this whole group, the people who published Vecker and others. Baruch walked me over to a group of these people after my talk in Borough Park. The people who look, they live in the communities, but you're right. But the difference is, Baruch, that they're secret. They're secret just when they're among themselves. But I'm talking about people who publicly would dress a certain way and identify, go to a modern Orthodox show, identify with modern Orthodox ideals, but still dress a certain way. You're speaking of these people like Maranos. You know, they look like they're Satmar Hasidim on the outside, but on the inside, they also went to Josh Berman. Josh Berman has written two articles. He spoke to them on Zoom and he spent Shabbos with them. And I just was reading that in Kiryas Yoel, even, you have a shul for these people. My email is shapiro.m2@scranton.edu. I'm going to take this thing that Baruch sent me privately, and I'm going to save it here. Other than that, one more thing. Rabbi Barry Hartman. The Rav said many times this year, there were two Matan Torahs, before Rav Chaim and after Rav Chaim. Yes, well, that's what they think, that really Torah study is qualitatively different before Matan Torah and after Matan Torah. And when will I spend Shabbos in Williamsburg? Well, Josh was here without his family. He was coming for Pesach, he was coming here. I think the rest of the family was home. My son in the whole yeshiva went to see Josh Berman today. He gave him a shir. My wife has a rule, Baruch. I don't go away for Shabbos unless I've been paid. So I don't know. Okay, thank you all for joining us. Rabbi Kelman.
Yes, sir. Why can't Satmar pay? They got lots of money, Satmar. That's why they split. I mean, we won't go there, but...
Maybe they will. If they ask me if they will, I'll go. I've been with Satmar, but never on Shabbos. I've been with Satmar many times, but never on Shabbos. So.
For those interested, one of the early classes, probably over 10 years ago, on our great rabbinic series, you know, what we sort of will get back to in a few weeks when we started on Shaul Lieberman, but one of the early ones was on the Satmar Rebbe. I believe there were two classes on the Satmar Rebbe back when we first started, and they're actually quite fascinating to listen to. If you go on the website, the ideology of Satmar, it's not our ideology, of course.
We had Satmar on it. When we did it, we had Satmar people on the show with us. So.
But anyways, okay, we have a broad world out there. Lots of different hashkafot. What can I say? Talking about the Satmar Rebbe, although that's not really connected, tomorrow, our next class, Ora Wiskin, is continuing her series on Hasidut, the Baal Shem Tov and his ideological thought and the teaching he did. She's, of course, an expert in the field. That's tomorrow at 11 a.m., part four for series. And then at 1:30, Ilana Goldstein-Sachs on Megillat Rut. And then Wednesday, Marty Lakshin and Lori Novick and Moshe Sokolov with the regular classes all during the week. And like I've been mentioning, Thursday night, please God, Parsha Shir, Shaul Robinson, Rabbi Shaul Robinson of Lincoln Square Synagogue, doing the Parsha Shir this week. And I'll be in Perkei Avot Shir Friday morning. Anyway, everybody should be well, should hear good things. Dr. Mark, by the way, I read the article you mentioned last week by, Brody on... when your parents, it's a fascinating article. And Dr. Mark mentioned last week this article by, what's his first name?
Shlomo Brody.
By Shlomo Brody, right? In the article in the Halakha, he just published on if parents are mochel you from mourning for 12 months. And he basically demonstrates there's absolutely no rabbinic authority who believes that a parent cannot do that. In other words, everybody agrees a parent can tell a child, you don't have to mourn for me, at least after Shloshim. And kids can go to weddings, baseball games, do whatever they want for the year. And it's a fascinating article. The question is, and he mentions Rav Schechter's father did that to Rav Schechter. He told him not to mourn for a year. His own father, he wrote the article because his own father insisted and put it in writing that they not do Avelus after 1 month, only say Kaddish. And it's quite a fascinating article in Chakira. It's available online. And the question is, I don't know why, I don't know more people don't do that. It's a kind of...
I never even thought of it or even heard of it, that it was a concept.
You know, I had in the back of my mind, I know there's a whole discussion, is Avelus for the benefit of the living or the person who passed away, the deceased. So by Shiva, it's for sure for the deceased.
I had no idea that so many discussed it.
Right. So I knew this existed, and I knew there's been, I also know there's opinions in halakha that going to a wedding is never a problem. In other words, the problem in a, even if you hold, you have to mourn for the year, that's, you can't go to a baseball game, you can't go to a concert, but to go to a wedding, which is a mitzvah, of course.
Special mitzvah. I think it's Ramosha right. Even so says, go to the dinner of the yeshiva dinner.
Right. That's, he relied on that. Yeah. No, he relied on, but we all know that people generally don't do that. They go for the chuppah, you know, it's a whole funny thing. So the question is, why not? And so I knew sort of this, but to actually put it in writing, it's quite a fascinating article. But he basically, so nobody argues. Every single Rishon and Achron agrees that the major one that they can be mochel. Whether they should be mochel is a whole different question. He quotes people who say they should be mochel, just like we say parents should be waive the honor due, because they said it's very hard to fulfill it properly. It's very hard to fulfill all the laws of mourning, all the laws of honoring parents. So the parents say you don't have to do it, and then the kid can pick and choose what they want to do. So it's really a fascinating article. I just picked up, I only know about the articles last week. Dr. Mark mentioned the article in the class, and so I went to look at it. So if anybody's interested, I'm just letting you know. Yeah, but thank you.
Okay.
Okay, we'll see everybody. Hopefully we'll learn. We should have a good thing to select the budget.
I hear you.
All right, everybody be well. Laila Tov.
Bye.
Okay, how are you? Good. Okay. All right. Who says parents should take the mitzvah away from the kids? Yeah, all right, we have that a lot, Honor. I don't know. Maybe that's why they don't do it. I don't know. It's a fascinating article. And I think the practice is it hasn't been done so much. But if
you're muted. I don't hear you.
Question, but you don't hear me. I'm not muted, I don't think. Can
now we hear you?
Okay. No, I was just saying Rav Herschel Schachter's father did it, and he quotes in the article that he would sometimes, he went to a bris once and he got up, like, because the problem is there's sort of a married eye problem. People think it's so weird, you know, like, what's he doing at this wedding when, you know, his father passed away a few months ago. So that's, you have to sort of explain to people. And maybe people find that strange. And that's also quite an interesting thing. So Rav Schechter, in the article, he says Rav Schechter found it a little bit hard sometimes. And he would sometimes get up and say, and his father insisted that he part of the people that he should go to Simchas, and he should go. So that he would have aim work. Anyways, just interesting to pick up on. Then we should have happy occasions to all go to and for many years. Okay.
Rabbi Jay.
Yes.
Where can I find this article?
In Chakira. I just type in, or I'll type in how you spell it. Chakira is this magazine. Hold on a second.
Is it online?
Yeah, it's online. No, I read it online. I only know about it because Mark mentioned it last week. And
Chakira.org.
Yeah, Chakira.org. It's the current issue, and only about three of the articles you can read. But yes, you click on it, go to Chakira.org. I have it in the back here. If you can see upper left-hand corner there, I have a bunch of their magazines. It's the Flatbush Journal of Jewish Studies or something like that. And whatever. They have lots of interesting articles there. You can keep it busy for a long time. Okay. Can we end class? Anybody? Class ended a long time ago. Anybody have anything else they'd like to say? Okay. Lila.